Will stay with us. We're broadcasting throughout the day today. For those who are leaving us now, if your station is leaving us, you can go to democracynow.org. Li Fang, thanks so much for being
thanks
with
for
us. You're going out in the streets of The Intercept. We'll link to your piece. And we will be broadcasting for 7 hours on this inauguration day. Saturday from 10 Eastern Standard Time in the morning to 3, we'll be broadcasting from the main stage at the Women's March on Washington. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh, and thanks to the Howard University staff.
Welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal on WHFR Dearborn, WHFR.fm, the station making waves. My name is Jay Koronek, host of the new WHFR Journal, local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. And I'm joined in the studio by my usual co-host, our news director, news and sports director, John Conroy. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much, Jay. It's good to be here.
Yep. And of course, it's a big inauguration day, and we won't be talking about that, at least not directly. I mean, you just heard a great show about Democracy Now! Covering the event, and by now at 1 o'clock, it's probably a done deal.
Probably all done.
It probably all happened.
Signed, sealed, and delivered.
Yeah, but we're going to get now to the most important story, really. And that is the Detroit Auto Show. I mean, after all, yeah. Here we are in Detroit. Used to be auto capital of the world, not quite up to that standard anymore. But the Detroit Auto Show. Of course, I grew up in an auto workers family. My dad worked at Chrysler Corporation as a on the assembly line as a job setter. And he helped build DeSoto's back in the 50s, and then he was transferred to the Chrysler engine plant in Trenton, Michigan, real close to where you live downriver there, John. And so we always went to the auto shows just because it was part of my dad's environment, you know, and it was always sort of a family sort of thing. So for special insights, though, and I did go down this last Tuesday, folks, and I have some thoughts on this, but we like to get somebody who really knows what they're talking about with a lot of experience from one of the many automobile magazines. And of course, quite a few of them actually have their headquarters and their editorial staffs, their writing staffs in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I think one of them is in the Detroit area. I think Auto Week has got headquarters downtown. But anyway, Car and Driver magazine, the largest circulation car magazine, at least in the U.S., maybe in the whole world. We have their technical director on the line, Eric Tingwall. Eric, welcome to the journal. Whoops, he can't talk. Now you can.
Hi, Jay.
There we
Thanks
go.
Thanks for having me.
Sorry we didn't have your... circuit turned on there. We're only a college radio station, folks, you know, with volunteer staff, and but of course I'm sort of a paid administrator, and I always tell people, do what I tell you, do what I say, not necessarily what I do if I mess up. Okay, so I've already mentioned circulation of Car and Driver, but there's a lot of automotive magazines on the newsstands, monthly magazines in most cases. How is Car and Driver different? Do they focus on different kinds of cars, or only expensive cars or cheap cars? Give us a little of your insight about the marketing angle of Car and Driver magazine.
Yeah, as you mentioned, we are the largest car magazine in the United States. I think you can extend that to the world, too, just thanks to our population of the United States and the readership we have here. So our focus is really...
I was going to say, the number we have is that I have, and I think it's fairly recent, is over 1,200,000 printed copies, and that's, I think, just for the U.S., so that's
right.
Pretty remarkable. Of course, you have a website, too, but go ahead.
Right.
Go
ahead. CarAndDriver.com has millions of visitors every month as well, but we are really a sheet metal publication, both online and in print. We're focused on the newest cars. We do have a bit of an enthusiast bent. We love performance cars. We love things that are fast, things that are sleek. But the magazine really covers the entire spectrum of the U.S. automotive industry. We do comparison tests of full-size trucks, crossovers, minivans, and, of course, we love to get sports cars in there as well. We are also the most technical magazine, so our new car reporting is meant to be approachable for everybody, but we really value covering the latest, newest technologies, what that means for the future of the business, what it means for consumers in terms of the cars they'll be driving in the future. So we've done lots of coverage on electric cars, autonomous cars, the move from naturally aspirated engines to turbocharged engines, things that we're now seeing like 10-speed automatic transmissions. And we try to take these very sophisticated technologies and make them relatable to drivers, consumers, and enthusiasts.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive coverage, I think. I've been a longtime subscriber. In fact, oh my gosh, when it first was published, it was actually called Sports Car Illustrated. I can't remember if it was the end of the 50s or early 60s, and I've subscribed all the way through, although I always subscribe to about five or six every month. I'm really a car guy, you might say, in terms of finding out about all the new things. There's always something new and different, and I want to give credit to Car and Driver for also covering, and I think other magazines do too, but they actually sometimes have special stories on the political situation that has to do with car regulations and insurance, two issues, certainly a problem here in Michigan. So I'm always happy to see and amazed by the kind of coverage. So what does a technical director do at an automobile magazine? Do you fine-tune the engines or
what? At Car and Driver here, I am responsible for all of the technical facets of the magazine. So that is everything from planning those technical stories that I talked about earlier to ensuring the technical facts are accurate, and also making sure our testing is repeatable. The automakers in the industry really respect the testing that we do, so we do 0 to 60, quarter mile, braking tests, handling tests. We do that with every car that we test at the magazine. We also do periodic special tests looking into, say, the differences in how an electric power steering system works versus how a hydraulic power steering system works.
So you actually get physical contact with the cars, and you go out to some of these tracks too at times. You're not just like an editor of the stories checking the numbers.
That's right. Yeah, we have a constantly revolving fleet in the office of about 30 cars. And we keep most of them for about 2 weeks at a time and do our testing and evaluations, track fuel economy during that time, so that at the end of the day we can back up our impressions with some facts and figures as well that we've sought out ourselves and that we're not entirely dependent on the manufacturers.
So you're not fake news. You're not fake news at all. No, you're not just opinions. The opinions are all educated opinions, and they come from experience from the writers. But also there's the scientific facts too. Then you have numerous, I assume, test instruments of your own that measure some of the things that about the cars that the manufacturers might say one thing, but you're also doing your own measurements too. So what does it take, in case there's anybody listening out there who would like a job as a technical director for an automotive magazine? Not that they'd take your job, I think you mentioned to me when we made connection a couple minutes ago that you have a background not only as a journalist but also as an engineer too.
That's right, and I'm kind of the rare example. A lot of people in this industry have fallen into it, you know, found their way to it through a circuitous route. I went to Michigan State University and got a journalism degree and mechanical engineering degree simultaneously.
Wow, okay.
And I had received advice from an editor at another magazine before going to college saying, if you really want to set yourself apart, get that engineering degree.
Yeah.
And I did that and was fortunate. I did an internship with one of our competitors while I was in school and had a job waiting for me when I got out of school, and about 3 years later got an interview here at Car and Driver. So really, being able to write is obviously the most important thing, but then being able to understand the technical details and translate that into common English is the big differentiator.
And are you all alone in that with all of those writers and all the stories and all the testing going on?
We actually have quite a few people on staff with technical backgrounds.
Good.
So my predecessor, Don Sherman, had a master's degree in engineering.
Oh, yeah, I remember his name. Mm-hmm.
Yep, and so we have...
it's really everybody's responsibility to get it right about the tech side, the facts about the cars,
sure,
and the tests,
and
of course.
You know, it's one of the great things about working at a magazine with such a history is that we still have fact-checkers on staff.
And all right.
That's not true in many web-only publications these days.
We're not just talking about cars, no.
and so it's great to be able to really stand behind what we write and make sure that it's accurate.
Great. Well, keep up the great work. It's very needed component of automotive magazines that certainly, you know, the experiences, some of your writers have experience in either race car driving or, I don't know, rally driving, and as well as writing for automobile articles for years and years in various contexts. But it's great also to have the engineering side accurate. Well, tell me about, I assume you and probably most of the Car and Driver staff one time or the other went down to the Detroit Auto Show this year, maybe just to the press preview week. But what was your experience like? First of all, I'd like any thoughts you have about sort of the experience as entertainment. I assume even for press preview week, there was some exhibits that were just they looked more exciting, or they had a better display of some sort. So just from an entertainment point of view, what was special for you, and how much fun?
Well, the Detroit Auto Show is a highlight every year, right? It's great. You mentioned in the introduction that maybe we're not quite the Motor City capital that we once were, but this is still an industry that Detroit can have a lot of pride in, and it's still a leader in a lot of technical innovations, and so it's a great celebration of that. It's great to get out there and see what's changing and what's new, and you know, there were great stands from every manufacturer. The stands are really, when you think about the money and the time and the effort that goes into building those stands, they start in December. It's incredible. Ford has a two-story display with escalators taking you up to the second level. That's a temporary structure that someone's built there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So Ford has a quite big footprint there in Cobo, and
yeah, they had really big video screens. They even somehow rented and put one up on the outside of Cobo Center on the north side. I'm not sure I ever saw an automobile video screen outside that was so huge. I mean, I'm talking about 20 feet high and 30 feet wide at least, and that was on the north side as you're walking from Central Detroit down to the auto show. But yeah, a lot of people had big video screens, but Ford did there too. What did you think about the Lincoln box, as I call it?
Is that the Navigator?
No, I mean the way they displayed Lincoln cars. I didn't even go inside. They put up like walls around the Lincoln area, and I know they have some exclusive cars and special concierge services. What they call it, black label or something, when you buy
black label
a certain Lincoln
high-end trim level.
But I mean, it seemed very off-putting. Like they're not even inviting you to come by and look at the car, much less touch it. I just didn't like that kind of display.
Yeah, it's it's nice when they're open and you can move freely, right, from stand to stand and take in the entire environment.
I was in the Fiat Chrysler display, which is a huge area, a contiguous area, sort of, and I was surprised because at one point they turned off all the lights. And then the cars individually, the lights came on. I mean, not as if somebody was trying to break in, you know, with the alarms going off and flashing. But, I mean, the taillights and headlights came on. And it was very low-key, but it was like, wow, it really, like, woke you up. And that took a lot of coordination. I mean, the whole display went dark. And then the car lights came on for a while, and I think it was a minute or two, and then the regular display lights came back up. But for whatever reason, I thought that was a lot of fun somehow.
Yeah, there's some great theater there, right?
Mm-hmm,
and, you know, I'm surrounded every day by cars, but for the typical Detroiter, even if you're not an enthusiast, an automotive enthusiast, this is a great way to spend an evening, right?
Yeah.
It's an alternative to going to the movies. It's kind of high-end window shopping with this great opulent experience going on around
yeah.
you. And it's just a really nice way to spend an evening doing something different.
As long as we brought it up, we mentioned there's still 3 days to go. Today until 10 o'clock tonight, tomorrow 9 to 10, and Sunday 9 to 7. Now, they admit people up to an hour before the closing time. So tonight you have to get in by 9 and then they kick you out at 10 and so on. But they start at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning and also Sunday morning. And there are discounts for senior citizens, which I appreciate. Didn't even ask for my ID. I was insulted. I think I look young, but oh well. Anyway, so it's still going on, and it is quite an interesting display. However, I noticed, and maybe it was something having to do with the organization, the people that organize the North American International Auto Show. It seemed to me like compared to last year, they must have required all the exhibits to have a lounge area. I mean, a readily available place to sit down, usually nicely styled and padded, not just a wooden bench or something. And I seem to see them like everywhere. And I know a couple years back, I was thinking, wow, I'm getting tired, an hour and a half on my feet, and I can only sit for like 30 seconds in a car that might be open, and then somebody else yanks me out so they can get in. So that seemed a little different, but maybe that was because, and check me if I'm wrong, there was an awful lot of car brands that weren't down there, that weren't on display. I know it varies a little bit from year to year. Certainly a lot of the luxury car manufacturers haven't been down there very much because, well, they don't want their cars touched, I think. And they don't sell that many. It's expensive to put on these displays. Although I think last year, Maseratis were down there. I mean, official Maserati exhibit was down there. But they weren't there. Not Aston Martin, Bentley, Ferrari. I made a list here. Jaguar, Lamborghini, Land Rover wasn't there. Lotus, in addition to Maserati, McLaren, Mini, which I own a Mini Cooper S from a couple of years ago. Still having fun with that. Mitsubishi, I'm not sure they're still making cars in the U.S. I guess for the U.S. I guess they are. Porsche.
Yeah, they are.
Porsche, big surprise. I thought Porsche has been there every year that I've gone down there.
Yep. Porsche was the big loss this year.
Rolls-Royce and, of course, Tesla, who can't legally sell cars in Michigan through their corporate stores yet, anyway. And they haven't been down there for a couple of years. But maybe they had a little more floor space, so they said, not just spreading out your cars, but maybe you should put a lounge area in each of your exhibits, which I think that is a great idea. Also this year, compared to last year, I noticed an awful lot more of manufacturer representatives. I'm not talking about the presenters, the models, and maybe they were knowledgeable too, but an awful lot of people came up to me representing the car company, and I would ask my crazy car nut questions, I mean, somewhat in-depth and specific, and they always had an answer. I thought it was amazing. I got some amazing answers about, you know, equipment and specifications just by talking to people. And I've never seen so many manufacturer representatives, in addition to, of course, the touch screens, the computer things they have set up around there. But I think that was a great idea, too. And I can only assume that they were either requiring or strongly recommending that you have more, you know, really good manufacturer reps, really knowledgeable people around there. I really appreciated that anyway. Maybe in regard to Favor exhibits, John is retired a few years ago from General Motors, by the way, so he's kind of a car guy too. Go ahead, you ask a few questions.
Okay. Yes. Hi, Eric.
Hi, John.
I retired from GM powertrain about 8 years ago out of Ypsilanti, which is now going to be setting up a plant for autonomous and electric cars.
Yeah.
So I was curious about your 10 best cars in the Car and Driver magazine. What really stands out in your mind as far as those type of cars go?
Yeah, I should give a little background here on 10 best. We do this once a year, and rather than pick, say, a car of the year, we pick 10 of the best out there. And so this year's list spans the range from practical family vehicles like the Honda Accord, a Mazda 3, a Volkswagen Golf, up to the sportier end, including Chevrolet Corvette Grand Sport, Chevrolet Camaro, Ford Mustang, Shelby GT350, BMW M2, and then the new one that is maybe of most interest, the Chevrolet Bolt, and that is the electric car with an EPA-rated 238-mile range. Mm-hmm. It sells for a starting price of $37,495, and of course there is a $7,500 federal tax credit that reduces that under $30,000.
Not quite ready for sale in Michigan, I think. Maybe in the fall, from what I read.
Correct.
They're sort of rolling it out. But there's a question of how many Chevy dealers are actually going to be selling it, because they have to get somehow certified or authorized. I know that there's not... it's awfully difficult, terribly difficult to get a Ford Focus Electric. I think that was really just a Ford idea to get to pass the California compliance laws so they could sell other cars there. They really haven't tried to market that at all. And a few Ford dealers I've talked to in the Detroit area know nothing, and they're not going to be interested in selling you one. But Bolt may be different. Let's talk about the background. I think this was in the December issue of Car and Driver, and it's on, of course, your website. We're talking about the 2017 10 Best Cars, Car and Driver magazine. And for those that tuned in late, we have Eric Tingwall, who is the technical director of Car and Driver magazine Ann Arbor there. I like your 10 best list because of the overall criteria. First of all, prices. I mean, I know some of the readers, or at least people on the website that made comments, said, hey, why don't you have a Ferrari in there? They're great cars. But you have actually a very practical limit of about $80,000 retail price. Isn't that it?
That's correct. We set an $80,000 price cap, and then you'll also notice that the list itself doesn't necessarily crowd that $80,000 price cap, right? So we have a Honda Accord on there, which starts below $25,000. Mm-hmm. Volkswagen Golf, the Mazda 3, they're all affordable $20,000 vehicles. Of course, the higher-end stuff gets towards $50,000 and $60,000.
Mm-hmm.
But we very much, when we're voting, value is one of the real criteria.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. Yeah, value for the money, which is maybe hard to identify, but I know that your editor-in-chief, Eddie Alderman, is always really stressed that that's got to stay in these ratings, that you consider value for the cost. And that's not usually done, along with a price cap, maybe. I mean, it would be fun for, you know, your writers to get together and decide which is the best Ferrari or luxury sports car. I mean, it's fun, but it's not in the practical range for most people. But, of course, the Chevy Bolt, I guess we should mention, was one of the cars also that was a specific winner of awards that the North American International Auto Show decided to give. I think that was in the regular consumer sedan category. There was a Honda Ridgeline for pickup, and then there was the Chrysler Pacifica. And I don't know if that was their SUV category or whatever, truck
minivan category.
The minivan, yeah.
You're right. That's a crossover minivan. It's a joint category.
Now, I think those are all really excellent choices, and I highly recommend them. A lot of people ask me, well, what kind of car do you recommend, Jay? And, of course, I'm not an expert, but I always tell them to look at magazine reviews, especially Car and Driver. But the Chevy Camaro, I think you're only really recommending the Camaro with their special package, the 1LE, or is that a Camaro, any Camaro that you put
we
in that category?
We are recommending select versions, more than the 1LE, though. So we recommend only coupes because the convertible has some chassis rigidity issues that cause, you know, the cowl, the dash in front of you, the framed windshield to shake, and just not really as stout as the structure should be. So we're recommending only coupes, only V6 and V8 models. Mm-hmm. And so that includes the regular SS V8 and also the 1LE package is a kind of chassis handling package that you can get with either the V6 or the V8.
Interestingly,
we are not recommending the turbocharged four-cylinder powertrain.
And just like the Ford Mustang is even a little more specialized or within their range, you're apparently only recommending, based on all your criteria, the Shelby GT350, which I think is sold out for this year. I don't know. It's what some sales reps around town has told me. But that's about $55,000, I think, retail.
Right.
Something
and
like
that's
that.
500-plus horsepower. It's very much a Mustang's a sports car to begin with, right? But this is truly a high-performance sports car. Great to take out on the track. Tons of fun. Makes incredible noises. Just a really great car to drive.
There was a note in the Freep yesterday regarding they couldn't get the latest Mustang into the show this year.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that was Ford couldn't get it into the show and how much of it was Ford wanted to wait another week to make their big reveal because there's so much news being made at the Detroit Auto Show, right? And I think that might have been an intentional play on Ford's part to say, well, let's wait for things to quiet down a little bit, and then we'll show this latest updated Mustang.
The so-called 2018 Mustang. My understanding is it doesn't look too much different. It's been tweaked and styled a little bit from the 2017, and they've dropped their V6 for 2018 from the model line, and they're making the magnetic ride control, which Chevy Camaros have as an option or standard with certain packages, available in 2018. And I don't mean to show off here, Eric, but I read that very closely. Apparently, they're going to put their GT Performance Pack also on their convertible model. I hope the chassis is not too flexible for that, but we'll see. But I think that's, your website, carandriver.com, and of course, all the other car magazines, most of them also have their websites. People that are looking for a car, they really should read a wide variety of test reviews. There is a difference of opinion among the car magazines on some of these models.
I want to point out, Jay, we just, at the end of the year, celebrated putting 650 new car reviews on our website in the year 2016.
Wow. Yeah.
So there are not 650 nameplates on the market. So that means we have reviews on multiple powertrains, transmissions, different trim levels for different cars. So carandriver.com really has very comprehensive reviews for any new car someone might be interested in learning more about.
Of course, looking for specification information, sometimes your reviews have some of that data, but in terms of like in a table or, a chart area, I sometimes go to like Edmunds.com, and even there they change their website, so I've got to search like crazy to get to all the specifications. But even the manufacturers' websites, we're talking about Ford and Chevy and all the others, it's really a problem even to see, like, headroom for a front seat passenger.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things we do is you'll find charts in all of our comparison tests. And if you go to Car and Driver's website and get to the what we call the make model landing page. So if you want to go to Ford F-150, we have a page there that aggregates every story we've written about that
specific
model.
Okay.
If you find a comparison test with that car, you actually see with its competitors headroom, cargo room, overall length, all those kind of specs, you'll be able to find them.
We want to talk finally about autonomous cars. I know John has a few questions. Let me just tell a background joke, John. I read a story somewhere is that before preview week started, a lot of the automotive journalists got together and they made a deal is that every time they heard the word autonomous from a manufacturer's spokesperson's, you know, in their big presentations, they would take another drink. We're talking about alcoholic. And after the first 2 days, they decided they would all die if they had to drink that much alcohol. It seemed to be a common word from all the manufacturers, at least during press preview week, that they were working on that and they're on top of it. And what the heck are autonomous cars? Could you, I mean, that's evolving, but could you give us a definition to start it off here?
Well, I think everybody hears the term autonomous cars, and they imagine this kind of complete idyllic endpoint, which is you get in the car and there's not even a steering wheel in front of you, and you can look at your phone and read emails the whole time, and the car will navigate anywhere you want to go. Mm-hmm. And for now, for the foreseeable future, that's not quite reality. I'd say that's probably at least 5, maybe 10 years off, but it's getting there.
And let's go two specific instances that I know of. Of course, many cars today come standard, and this is amazing to me, not just the high-priced ones, with various kinds of driver assistance features. Maybe some people are familiar with some cars that will park themselves, parallel parking, if you're in the right situation for that, but others are also hazard avoidance messages, like there's somebody behind you and don't run them over, or maybe you wander out of your lane and you're not intending to change lanes and some sort of signal goes. So there's a whole bunch of these things, and it varies from manufacturer to manufacturer. Is you think are most of these good, at least within what they're trying to do for the driver assistance features?
Yeah, I think these are baby steps towards that bigger end goal, right? And the SAE, that's an industry group of engineers, defines autonomy on 5 different levels, level zero being no automation, and then level 5 being the full autonomy I mentioned, where you don't have to supervise the car, there's no steering wheel, the car takes care of everything. And the systems you're talking about are kind of level 1, and the best systems are up to level 2, which is a partial autonomy. Things like the Tesla Model S has a self-steering, auto-steer algorithm that will keep it in its lane quite well down the highway for dozens of miles at a time without the driver necessarily taking over or putting any input into the steering.
That's still sort of a level 2, even the Tesla Autopilot?
That's right, and it's a level 2 because it's depending on the human driver to still be paying attention the entire time and being ready to take over at any time.
I saw on the news today that there was an accident of a Tesla that supposedly was the driver was using Autopilot, I don't know, and they've been totally cleared of any problem that the car or the autopilot system might have had. But it was a big accident. I think somebody might have died even. It was just in the news today. I can't remember what source, michiganradio.org or something like that. So they've been cleared that they're not responsible for, you know, or their system is not responsible for that. But I'm just wondering, though, of course, if it's all autonomous cars, then Car and Driver is out of business, I guess. Although I guess you could do some kind of test on which autonomous cars handle better on a mountain road. But that doesn't seem like any fun at all.
I think autonomous cars are maybe getting here 10, 15 years from now. And I think the car as we know it has at least another 50 years beyond that, and especially in the personal ownership realm.
Yes, I was just going to say personal ownership is really a problem for me in terms of the cost to society. Wouldn't it be, somebody has to put out, what, $30,000, $40,000 or lease an autonomous car like they buy a regular car, and then... Why couldn't it just be improving mass transit? I mean, the extra money, of course, it would have to be collected in taxes or something. But
right. I think that's really a cultural thing, because if you talk to the Japanese automakers, Toyota specifically, they've said when we get to this level 5 autonomy, in Japan we start thinking to ourselves, why don't you just take the train?
Yeah.
I think mass transit is kind of politically fraught in the U.S. just to get that money to create those systems, right? And
right.
Our sense of individuality, our preference for privacy, we're more likely to see autonomous cars operated by companies like Google or Uber, where you just call them up on your cell phone, mm-hmm. vehicle pulls up and whisks you away to your destination, and you pay $10 or $20 for that trip. And
right.
if the system becomes so widespread, ultimately those people won't be interested in owning cars.
So the autonomous features might be putting the Uber drivers out of business. I mean, they won't need drivers.
Yeah, that's absolutely Uber's end goal. You know, that company, it's pretty clear they cannot be profitable unless they can eliminate the driver from their payroll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, John just penciled a comment about whether or not I've ever driven or been part of an autopilot car or driver assistance car, and no, I haven't. Have you, Eric?
The closest I've been is in the Tesla Model S, so I haven't experienced any of Google's work, or Uber has some of its own prototypes running around.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla's autopilot's the closest I've come, which will do a pretty convincing job going down the highway. It can't really navigate urban environments, but it does a great job keeping in its lane and watching out for traffic ahead of you.
Yeah, if I'm driving at all, I'd like to be involved. You know, I completely support the Car and Driver campaign from a few years ago. I know it's just a marketing campaign, perhaps, but save the manuals, save manual transmission. I think it should be expanded to save the manual driver in general, because I just can't imagine it would be any fun for me anyway not to be shifting and braking and steering and just being totally alert. I love being totally alert when I'm driving, especially if I'm driving a good car. And no, it's not a plug, but I've driven BMWs and I had a Mazda RX-7 rotary sports car a while back. I had a Corvette, although I didn't like that. Oh, my God. That was a few years ago, but never again. I really like to be involved. It is actually a fun part of my life, and that's crazy. I mean, why don't I just go out drinking at night or something and partying, but it's a fun part of my life to drive safely, but also very well, you know, to get somewhere. And sometimes just go out for what used to be called a pleasure drive. You know?
Right. I mean, you and I really appreciate a car that is engaging, a car that activates the driver and invites them to drive spiritedly or, you know, to pay attention to what's going on around them. And the one thing I think that's interesting about these kind of semi-autonomous systems, like in the Tesla Model S, is that without even some base-level engagement involved in driving the car, you quickly become complacent. You're kind of lulled into a false sense of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
You stop paying attention. You say, hey, you know, the car's doing such a good job, maybe I'll send off an email or something.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, Tesla's counting on the driver to have a hand on the wheel at all times and be ready to take over at any moment. So for regular consumers, there's a safety implication to this kind of middle ground before the industry gets to true autonomy.
Right.
Vehicles that can handle all situations.
Yeah. I'm just going on record saying I don't want to ever buy a car or drive a car with any sort of driver assistance or autopilot. I mean, it may be a convenience at a certain point, but especially if I can't turn it off, I don't want to be in that car. I don't want those decisions made by these computers. And certainly for the next, who knows, 10 or 20 years, it won't be as good as human judgment. I know it'll keep improving. But yeah, if I want to take a bus or a train, I'll do that somewhere if I'm, you know, in that situation. But I just, for the sheer fun of a few minutes to a few hours a day, I don't want to pass up on a great car. Well, we're going to let you go, Eric, now. Get back to your tech checking at Car and Driver Magazine. Eric Tingwall, the technical director of Car and Driver Magazine, headquartered in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Say yes to Michigan. We really appreciate your time and all of your expertise. By the way, what's your personal favorite car?
I'm a sucker for Porsches.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last version of the Cayman that just went out of production about a year ago with the six-cylinder.
Oh, yeah, the six-cylinder.
And they made a Cayman R, manual transmission, kind of track
special. We're getting expensive, but yes. I understand. Yeah, I understand. It's interesting. I was just looking up sales in the U.S. The Mazda Miata MX-5 sold about 8,000 last year in the U.S., and the Boxster Cayman models together, maybe it was a little, the numbers were down because they were switching from the six-cylinder to the four, or people were waiting for the newer model, but they only sold about 5,000 in the U.S. So, of course, there's a price difference. The Miata's half the price of the Boxster Cayman, so.
Sure.
That probably made the difference, but yeah, certainly great cars. I think I've talked to a couple other people over the last several years. I don't know if, I know Eddie Alderman last year said he wanted a Mercedes-Benz sedan, AMG sedan. I can't remember the model number, but other than that, the Porsche has been on the list of most writers, certainly, and I just highly recommend people get all the information. Don't take our opinions. You got to get out there and see if the car fits you and if you like the way it drives. But you need to know all the technical data, too, about the car, servicing, other tech issues that might be a problem with performance or handling. And Car and Driver and the other magazines that are out there, collectively, they do a fantastic job to help you, number one, get your money's worth, the best value in your car choice, but also number two, the most fun too. Because I think it should, if you have to drive a car, I think it should be not just a good car, but one that you can have some enjoyment from the experience too. So thanks for all your time today, and we'll get back to Car and Driver hopefully next year for your spin on the car show and what's happening. Thanks so much, Eric.
Great. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Eric. Yep.
Okay, so we're back to the WHFR Journal, the new WHFR Journal for Friday, January 20th. Happy Inauguration Day. We have some local stories to feature now, but let's take a listen to Jack Lessenberry comment as we change our microphones around here. And he's talking about, yes, this is important. He wasn't very impressed with Governor Snyder's State of the State speech. So we'll just listen to that one commentary from Jack Lessenberry, Michigan Public Radio, and we'll be back with local stories here on the new WHFR Journal, WHFR.fm station, Making Waves.
I'm Jack Lessenberry. Governor Rick Snyder gave his annual State of the State speech last night. If you missed it, don't feel bad. There is virtually nothing to miss. I've seen five different governors deliver these annual speeches over the last 40 years. None of them will live for the ages. Years ago, after one, a reporter from United Press International turned to me and said, "We have nothing to fear except fear itself and another speech next year." But in a world of forgettable speeches, this was probably the weakest. The governor came into the legislative chamber with his wife and kids. Very early on, I realized that this speech seemed largely to be the governor attempting to justify his last 7 years in office to himself and perhaps his family. Essentially, he used a good deal of it to recount successes he believes he's had, though many of them may have been mostly a function of the improving national economy. State Representative Henry Yanez, a Democrat from Sterling Heights, was especially brutal in his comments to the new service Mears. I think he might as well have just said, President Barack Obama saved the auto industry, and there's a bunch of other stuff. Good night, and go home. That's a little too harsh, but not very. Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, not known for cheap shots, said that if the speech had been soup, it would have been broth because there was nothing in it. At times, the governor bordered on the bizarre. Long before his brief mention of the continuing crisis in Flint, the governor seemed to obsess over cows. He went on and on about how our dairy cows were the second most productive in the nation and that the winners, the cows of Colorado, should move on over. The governor indeed spent as much time on the cows as on Flint, about which he essentially said, things are getting better, but there's still more work to do. To my astonishment, he did not even mention the huge unemployment insurance scandal in which the state incorrectly accused more than 20,000 people of fraud and assessed huge fines and in some cases garnished their wages. The vast sinkhole in Fraser got only a brief mention. Candace Miller, now Macomb County Public Works Commissioner and, as loyal a Republican as they come, said she was disappointed by that. The governor did say we should do more about infrastructure, but neither offered any new programs nor suggested how we might pay for the improvements we need. Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff, who always does his best to obstruct any kind of progress, quickly indicated he had no inclination to provide new money for infrastructure needs. Instead, though the governor never mentioned it, the lawmakers are focused on cutting taxes and lessening the money they have to work with. The governor did say he wants to keep the Healthy Michigan Plan, which has provided Medicaid to more than 500,000 residents and has resulted in a healthier workforce. But it's not clear what will happen if, as expected, Washington repeals Obamacare. Next year, the governor will give his very last State of the State speech. Right now, it's hard for me to imagine what more he'll have to say.
Jack Lessenberry is Michigan Radio's news analyst.
And we're back with more WHFR Journal for Inauguration Day. And we're, again, not talking about the inauguration. That's not our place here. But we do have some thoughts about it, and we just gave you Jack Lessenberry's thoughts about the State of the State address, which is very strange. I know John Conroy was telling me he thought it was a strange speech. Never saw anybody so positive in their own world. Governor Snyder didn't seem to be touching on the real world that is the Michigan that we know, or the many problems. I know there's a lot of good things about Michigan, no doubt, but he didn't seem to talk about them. He just sort of just went past it all, just totally in a different universe or something. And that's, I think, what Lessenberry was referring to. John, we want to cover a story we were going to bring up last week, but you actually attended a specific meeting. It was here on campus yesterday about Henry Ford College becoming identified, in fact, maybe officially by some future vote of the Board of Education, Board of Trustees of Henry Ford College, a sanctuary college. Why don't you take a little time, just a little time here, explain what is a sanctuary college, what about that meeting last night, and also introduce our special guest who also attended that meeting.
Certainly, Jay. Thanks. John McDonald, the president of the union, was the leader of this of the meeting. And there were, I'm going to say, 70 to 80 students that were there, as well as administrators and faculty from Henry Ford College. And it was outlining the idea of what sanctuary college principles and the commitments that are wanted by the HFCC Local 1650. He made some opening comments, President McDonald did, and then he kind of opened the floor for questions. And I would kind of like to, and I have here with us Byron Brooks, who is on the student council at Henry Ford College. And Byron had some interesting thoughts about the whole meeting, and I'd like to hear what you had to say, Brian.
All right. Good afternoon.
Byron, sorry.
Well, really, a school of sanctuary is just a school that is committed to being a safe and welcoming place for all, that's including students and staff, so. Martin Luther King once said that what affects one directly affects all indirectly. So Imagine if we had students that felt that they weren't safe here. And then a lot of people would not register for the school. If we don't have too many people registering for the school, that would affect us, because then we would lose grants. We would lose a student base. And I feel anybody who's eager to learn and it deserves a quality education and should not feel like they would be harmed or feel misunderstood or misplaced when they enter into this community. We should feel as a family, as a college should feel, you know.
Specifically, John or Byron, what sort of threats are we talking about here that would endanger the safety? What sort of things are envisioned maybe or is possible?
The perception was regarding having a citizen or a registry of some sort and maybe an ID for folks that were not naturalized citizens of the United States. And there was a perceived, like I said, a perceived notion that this was going to happen with a new administration in place. And they even liken it to back in the days of Germany and registering the Jews, the Jewish folks.
And this kind of registration results in a kind of constant profiling or constant identification or watching. And yes, a general stereotype is built, because if some people are registered and the others aren't, of course, I'm against an ID for everyone also, but registration for everyone. But if some are registered and some aren't, that means you're getting different class of citizenship and access. In some cases, people say, well, you're registered. I'm not going to do this or that for you, whatever it happens. So there is actually a threat there. And you can look back. Of course, we have many opinions on this show. Opinions are just those of us here, not the station in general or the college, but John, myself, and Byron are, together that the concept is a good one, whether it's specifically codified, as they might say. I always think of a fish, codified, I guess you could pronounce it, by the Board of Trustees. But it is general policy already. I think, Byron, you were suggesting that earlier. That in a way we have a lot of things in place at the college that demands equal treatment and no second-rate student classifications.
Yeah, then it could be students. If you was registered, then a teacher could look at a student differently because of this registration, and that teacher, that can affect that student's grade and how that teacher acts on if he really truly wants to help educate this student.
Yes.
And every student should be treated equally with the level of education. Every student should walk out here well-rounded with a quality education.
Yeah, so I was there any thought by this? And we had a representative from the Board of Trustees there, too, also known as the Board of Ed for the public schools. Was it the new president? And I forget who is the current president of the board. Or who was hosting for the board last night? Did you write that down?
Miriam Bazzi.
Yes, Miriam Bazzi.
She
okay.
was there.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. I hope they do bring it up and talk about it. It's not certain they will. Maybe there's the assumption we're already doing a great job. We don't want to get in trouble with the federal government, the new federal government. But you want to be proactive, I think, to make sure that people know that you're not in favor of any of these kinds of classification and what becomes restrictions, too.
Trying to progress, not
yeah,
here.
Yeah.
There was more. There's also some discussion about diversity initiatives that have already happened, and the fact that John McDonald, he talked about his Irish background as his calling card, and others said, "Well, that's interesting. Your name kind of shows or highlights that you may be the Irish, but that our names don't necessarily show our whatever ethnic background we are." And so that's another reason why we're afraid of this idea of the perception of the idea of being put into a category or registry of some sort.
Yeah, we try to minimize the differences from having anything to do with the educational experience. You can only go so far with that. I mean, it's amazing. In the olden days, we actually had – I started in the English department here in composition. In the early days, there weren't so many people using computers for writing, for papers. But there were studies that clearly showed that people with bad handwriting writing the same words would get a lower grade from a teacher than if it was typed and turned in. The same words, spelled the same too, even if they hand wrote some spelling problem, that the teacher would still give a higher grade to the typed paper. So they started making it a standard that everybody has to turn in a typed paper to sort of take away the handwriting as some sort of criteria on the quality of thoughts, you know, which is what composition is all about, really, the organization and the expression, of course. And so there's all kinds of factors, but whatever we can do to minimize the differences so that people get a fair and full educational experience. Byron, you're a member of the Henry Ford College Student Council. I just want to commend you for your efforts, not only with the council, but to reach out and to attend some of these special meetings that affect us. And we thank you very much for coming by and expressing your opinion on the Journal show today, so that our the whole community can start thinking about this too, and maybe make a statement as a community at the city council too, if there's an issue there. We have just one more segment. I want to play actually a comment from Garrison Keillor to finish the show. Some of his words at the end of 2016. He is part of Prairie Home Companion still. He does his news from Lake Wobegon, which is a fictitious community that he has sort of created these oral histories for, most somewhat humorous, but he has a little comment about the end of 2016 and the beginning of 2017 I'd like to end the show with today. Any final thoughts about that story, John, or something else in the community?
Just very quickly, the statement that I wanted to read was Henry Ford College. This comes out of yesterday's meeting. Must recommit to defending the ideals upon which it was founded and its students. The HFCC-FT Executive Board urgently requests that Henry Ford College trustees declare HFC a sanctuary college and make the following commitments to protect our college community and our shared values. And then again, it goes into all the principles and commitments that were listed in the publication.
Mm-hmm. So. We don't have a chance to go in depth of it here. Thank you very much, John.
Yep.
But in the News Herald, newsherald.com this week, and several people downriver, several communities concerned about water, the taste and smell of the water there, and there are reasons for that, but the Great Lakes Water Authority, all capital letters, first letters, capitals, they must be important, GLWA, say that all the water is now safe for people and pets. All testing completed on the water, leaving the treatment plant and in the distribution system, this is as of just yesterday, have met the regulatory standards set in the EPA Safe Drinking Water Act. And all samples were tested for toxicity, that is poisonous, and the results indicated none. Okay. But if you have any problem, of course, contact, they say, the GLW directly. Okay. However that happens, look it up on the website or something. But the water is safe to drink for people and pets, but that certainly troubling with the Flint issue and so on about taste and toxicity for downriver water. It doesn't include Dearborn, but at this point.
There is some discoloration in today's waters.
Okay. Okay, John. Well, there you go. All right. Thank you for listening to our show today, our auto show special, and happy Inauguration Day to everyone. Here is the comment from Lake Wobegon and Garrison Keillor as we finish our show. A four-hour blues show hosted by Mike Holloway today. Go with the flow, Mike, is coming up right after this commentary. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Well, the gospel message this morning at the Lake Wobegon Lutheran Church, in case you missed the service, was the epistle. Was the verse from the Colossians in which it says to put on the clothes of compassion and kindness and to forgive each other as God has forgiven us and put on, dress yourselves in love, it says approximately. I hope that clothing yourself in love does not mean wearing the clothing that they wore in San Francisco in 1967. I've already been there and done that. But keep that in mind as we come up to the new year, which is just a few minutes away. Somebody sitting next to you, maybe, or somebody in your thoughts. New Year's Eve, a time when we probably have known some of the worst nights of our lives. If you want to go back and remember, evenings when you were trapped in small, noisy rooms with people you did not care for. And perhaps that was what led you to accept the third drink, that fatal third drink that night. And suddenly you needed to get elsewhere quickly, but you couldn't get there fast enough. And you became a social liability right there on the floor, with other people looking at you in horror. And you were helped home by your spouse, who was scornful. And you crawled into bed feeling more dead than alive, feeling like the object of a cruel experiment. And you woke in the morning with a lag bolt in your forehead and with your left eyeball coming out of your socket, and nothing to look forward to but an afternoon of television and football with your stomach full of sand and feathers, feeling horrible. That was the worst. Okay, that was the worst. So now we lift ourselves up towards this next year. Clothe yourselves in compassion and take care of the people you love. And let's make it a wonderful, wonderful good year. Make sure there's music in it, and do something for your children. Nothing you do for children is ever wasted. Remember that. Especially those of you who are my age. Nature has no further purpose for us, you know, after we have begat our children and gotten them to a certain place. So we have to find some new reason to be in the world, some good to do, something to bring to other people. I wish you well. I wish you a very, very happy new year.
Good afternoon. This is WHFR Dearborn. You're listening to the program called Highway 61.